The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We know that central banks manipulate, suppress gold, etc., etc. Today, I believe they're buying gold because of fear. I believe that they see major looming problems in the world financial system, currency system, the trade war, potential for shooting wars, etc., etc. I think there is genuine fear on the part of the central banks, and I believe that's why they're buying as much gold as they're buying today.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick. We'll be joining David McIlvaney and Don McIlvaney in a moment. You know, for 32 years, I started working for Don McIlvaney 32 years ago, and I was just amazed at the type of company it was. Very family-oriented, very deliberate, not only in the business, but with the way Don raised his family. And both Don and David have a rescuer mentality. That was something I had never really encountered. When I first came to work for Don, it was amazing how he truly just wanted to help people with, in that case, their savings or orphanages. And now he and Molly, Don and Molly, both live in the Philippines at one of the 9 orphanages that they help with around the globe. Don's main focus through the years, and you'll hear this in this program, has been getting people to understand the times that they live in. Well, about once a year, Don and David and the families get together, and they go over to some exotic place. In this case, they're in Italy. And last week, on his way over to Europe, Don stopped here in Durango. It was great catching up. We got to have breakfast together, and you know, we just talked about the years of family meetings and business meetings. You know, we've got people here at this office that have been here 3 to 4 decades, and so we feel, in a way, like McIlvaney family. One of the things that we talked about when David and I were first starting this show was this would be a fulfillment of a yearning that I had had actually for several decades, that when we had these meetings with Don and now with David, I just wish that the people who knew us could be a fly on the wall and listen in. And today, that's exactly what we're going to do. Don and David are in Italy, and they just had a family conversation, one of many that they've had in the past. They reminisce about the company, reminisce about 50 years, about 47 years, almost 48 years in the gold business. Don started this business back when gold actually was illegal here in America, and he found a way to legally place people into gold at a period of time where people were not allowed to invest. So go ahead and listen in and enjoy this father-son meeting. You can imagine them sitting somewhere in Italy. And in enjoying the talk about the history of the family and the company, you'll also get a good perspective of the history of the gold market over the last 50 years.
Sometimes it's important to pause and reflect on how you arrived where you're at. We're a second-generation family business, and 47 years is a lot of time to be doing something, anything. And in this particular case, it's precious metals brokerage and asset management. It's been 47 years since you and Mom together started our precious metals brokerage business. In that time, we've helped 50, 60,000 investors, and they've acquired or sold billions of dollars in gold and silver. And what's interesting to me, and probably not well known, is how the industry has benefited from your role in it. So perhaps in a little bit we can talk about kind of some of the things that happened in the 1970s. There was a time when owning gold in the U.S. was not legal, the time between 1933 and 1975. And, you know, for many of our listeners, they know we ran a 2-tier monetary system that allowed for domestic inflation, inflation of our money in circulation, but we maintained credibility with the foreign central banks that we dealt with and foreign creditors because we settled with them in gold. So gold was still a part of our system, but just not for the average guy or gal on the street. So we never suffered a significant credibility issue. You're uniquely a man on a mission. I mean, Don McIlvaney, there's only one of a kind, only one that I know, a human being quite like you. And there's never been a project or an engagement that you're involved in that didn't involve a cause or a rescue or a deeper purpose. And I do want to dive into the history of the times, which were sort of the background to our business being created, and some of the things that are sort of a retrospective of our business. But before we do that, you chose to engage in the financial arena, again, being a person who is oriented towards a cause, a rescue mission, a deeper purpose. There must be a why. Why the cause? Why the rescue? Why the fight?
Well, I went to Wall Street probably looking for a little of excitement. I was quite bored working for the Dow Chemical Company, and I realized that I liked interaction with people, and the financial system definitely got my attention and excited me. And so I went to Wall Street in 1968, New York Stock Exchange firm. But David, about 1970, I had one of my clients. I was in Houston, Texas at the time, and he was buying South African gold stocks, stocks that I couldn't even pronounce. And I said, why are you buying these stocks? This makes no sense. I mean, who's ever heard of these stocks? And the guy spoke very kindly to me, and he said, you're dumb as a rock, and I'm going to educate you. So the first thing he did was he gave me a book by Harry Brown, How to Profit in the Coming Devaluation, which was probably one of the most life-changing books I ever read. It was just on the simplicity of the financial system, how it was being ruined by politicians and central bankers and so forth, and what was coming next and why there was going to be an explosion in gold. And I read it, and it lined up with my probably more conservative political philosophy and so forth. And so I said, but gold's not legal. I can't buy gold. I would like to buy gold. I can't buy gold. And then a friend of mine came along and said, I know how to buy gold. And this was 5 years before gold was legalized. And I said, how's that? Well, I have a friend out in Wimberley, Texas, and he has created a special loophole in the Treasury prohibition against gold, whereby he makes solid gold religious medallions, 1 and 2 ounce medallions.
This is just, it's bullion. It just happens to have a religious imprint.
Yes.
And that was the loophole.
It was a legal loophole before gold was legalized. So I went and met this man, started buying these medallions, and then, you know, I continued as a stockbroker, and I was visiting with a man, I will never forget the man. He was a survivor of the Hungarian Revolution and a brilliant man who was a top executive in storage technology up in Boulder, Colorado. And I was just closing on a limited partnership. And I reached in my pocket and said, now, here, let me show you what I invest in. It's I pulled out two of these 2 ounce medallions, and I handed them over the desk to him, and he looked at them, and he looked at them, and his eyes got very big. And now, background of this guy, he had come through the Hungarian Revolution. He knew the realities of the world, the financial system of gold and so forth. He looked at me and said, can you get me $50,000 worth of these, and how soon can you get them for me? And I stuttered because I had never even thought about selling them. I was just going to invest in them myself. So that was the beginning. That was the beginning of our company. And yes, I did get the medallions for him. And then gold was legalized on January 1 of 1975.
So the history, just for kind of a background, you know, you mentioned 68, you're in the stock market. 68 is when Jacques Rouff is pounding the table with the French government and saying, you know, look, we don't see this as going well. He had been around for the British devaluation in the 1930s. And so he was wanting de Gaulle to take very seriously the exposure that the French had to the United States government. And he said, make sure you're settling all of your transactions in gold. And so 68, you know, there's already things shifting in the marketplace, although it didn't become acute until 1971. And take us back a little bit. You've got the Johnson era. You know, again, you studied chemical engineering. You figured out that the world of Dow Chemical was of less interest to you. Business and finance was of more interest in the Dow Jones. Kind of captured your imagination. That's how you were ending up in the stock market and investing. But maybe you can reflect a little bit on the Johnson administration, late 60s as we head towards Nixon, and just kind of what the backdrop was. What was the feel in the marketplace at the time?
I think most people in the market were oblivious to what was happening and to some of the financial problems which were coming in the 70s. Only a tiny handful then, as now, really, I think, understood the realities. Nixon was president. he had declared, as well as John Conley, his Secretary of Treasury, that we would never, ever devalue the U.S. dollar. Never would happen. And it was interesting, after one of those strong statements.
Was it hours or days thereafter?
It was less than 24 hours. I remember standing at the stock ticker and looking at the news come across as, I believe it was August 15th of 1971. I could have the day off. And I remember sitting there reading it and saying, wow, this is just incredible. Now, most people had no idea what was coming next. And what was coming next was a lot of inflation and a lot of fundamental changes. I understood some of it because of reading Harry Brown's book, How to Profit in the Coming Devaluation. So it was an exciting time for me, and especially because in that time frame, I had found a way to invest in gold. And that's when we started our company. We said, hey, our company started helping people fight off the coming inflation, devaluation, and so forth, because we saw these things coming. But what we were selling solid gold religious medallions, which were the only legal way to buy gold until January 1 of 1975.
Well, so the backdrop of the, it sounds like Harry Brown was quite the influence.
He had a big influence, plus this customer of mine who told me I was dumb as a rock and was educating. He did a great job in educating me.
So some guy says, McIlvaney, you're stupid, and gives you a lecture on owning gold. And for a lot of people on Wall Street, whether it's ego or being wrapped up in the preferences of a given financial firm, that conversation would have been quickly written off, would have been ignored, or at least soon forgotten. It sounds to me like you were listening, you were learning, and you had enough humility to engage in an area where he knew more than you did.
He did indeed, and I think it was a lesson. Myself and our kids and you and we all need to learn to be teachable. There's always somebody that comes along that's smarter than we are. I think one of the things that made the gold story so real to me is I basically had a mistrust of big government. As I worked on Wall Street, I also developed a big mistrust of Wall Street. I saw Wall Street doing an awful lot of self-serving things. So that distrust plus understanding some of the fundamentals of what was going to happen as they were opening the printing presses up in the 70s and so forth, it was life-changing for me. And I think I had this strong compulsion. I want to help people protect their assets. And that was the basic fundamental premise on which we started our company. We want to help our clients to protect their assets and be prepared for hard and difficult times. And many of them don't understand it. So if we can bring understanding, as we gain understanding and share that understanding with people, maybe we can help them through what could be tough times.
Now, the business started in 72. You had already gone to work. You'd left the boutique firm that you were working with in Denver, Betcher & Company, responsible for a lot of municipal bond underwriting in the state of Colorado, and great company, great family. But these were clients at Betcher who had an issue, you know, great tax-free income, but no real protection against inflation. So gold was a decent fit. Your move was next to a Wall Street mutual fund run by John Van Eck. Tell us a little bit about Van Eck and the Gold Share Mutual Fund, because actually, you know, you're working there and mom is running the precious metals business in those early years while you're still at Van Eck. Give us some of that history.
Well, I left Wall Street and then a year or so later came back to Wall Street and went on to become sales manager for this International Investors. It was the largest gold share money manager or mutual fund in the world at the time. John Van Eck ran it and was a very, very far-sighted guy who understood the economic financial system and so forth. So I started traveling around the country at that time in 1973 and lecturing to stockbrokers and any groups of clients they would bring together about gold, inflation, and the world monetary system, and so forth. And occasionally, these people would ask me, well, we have clients that would like to buy hard gold, gold and silver. This was especially true after 1975. And so I said, well, there's a little woman in Colorado, Molly Brown, That was her maiden name, Molly Brown McIlvaine, who can help you, help your clients and so forth. So stockbrokers begin to call her and place orders. So as the next 4 or 5 years went by, and I continued to travel around the country and lecture and talk about the monetary system and so forth, more business began to filter into Molly Brown out in California, and when people wanted to know where and how they could buy the metals. And then the day came when she was begging me to come home and run what looked like a blossoming little coin company. One day in the fall of 1979, that came about. I decided, okay, I'm going to go home, I'm going to run my company. And so that was kind of the beginning of our little company. We had a very, very small beginning. And I told my wife, I said, when you get to the point where you're doing $1 million a month in business, I will strongly consider coming home. Well, you know, I guess I reneged on that promise because I waited until she got to almost $2 million. And then the day came when she was doing almost $1 million a day in business. So as we were moving towards 1979 and 80 in the top in gold, gold volume, interest in gold rose dramatically. And so I decided, I think I better go home and help my wife run this company.
There is a certain character to the business flow and the volume and the interest at particular points in the market. And one thing that you've said repeatedly growing up is that investors have a hard time doing the right thing at the right time. They tend to move in mass. And in fact, you kind of raised me with this idea that the majority is always wrong. 1979, 1980 was when you saw the highest volumes in the business in that particular cycle. And yet, it really was the wrong time to be coming into gold from a price perspective. We went into a 25-year bear market in metals thereafter, but you couldn't keep people from rushing the gates and buying whatever they could.
We tried to caution people about there being a pullback was coming, a retrenchment had to come somewhere in here, and a few listened and some didn't. And so the pullback came, and we went through a 20-year slow period in the metals. You know, they had their ups and downs, but basically we went from an intraday high in January of 1980 of about 875. And by the way, that was a 25-fold rise from the $35 an ounce. Silver did a little better. It did about 26-fold. So gold and silver had their day in the 1970s. But then we went into a retrenchment period, and Paul Volcker raised interest rates through the roof, 15% plus, et cetera, et cetera. So gold went into a long-term downtrend, and I think it bottomed around 253. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that was about right. And that was over about a 20-year period.
Now, there was a sense of solidarity when you go back to the 70s, early 80s, and kind of the industry as a whole, the precious metals industry. There was a sense of solidarity between those and the gold industry in the early years. I say early because it was legalization 75. In kind of a practical expression of a philosophical ideal, you mentioned it earlier, maybe it relates to limited government or a focus on freedom, individual liberties, individual empowerment, autonomy from the system, not counting on the system to take care of you. Was that what was drawing like-minded people together within this small space within the world of finance and investing in the gold space, kind of a philosophical compatibility?
There was. A lot of the people who were buying gold back in the 70s, and some continued to buy in the 80s and dollar cost average and so forth, were probably politically more on the conservative side, had a bit of a mistrust of government, the central banks and so forth, and their printing press maneuvers. So I would say that the people, I think they were thinkers. The people who were buying gold back in the 70s and beyond were people who were thinkers who did not completely trust the system. Now, you might say, well, if gold was in a long-term downtrend, and none of us knew how long the downtrend was going to last, and yes, there was manipulation along the way. I mean, we haven't even touched on the manipulation, but in the 70s, I could tell you long stories about how the government, the monetary system, the central banks and so forth were manipulating gold. Why did we think gold still made sense? Because we saw it. I have life insurance, but it's not because I think I'm going to die tomorrow. I hope not. Fire insurance, I'm not expecting my house to burn down, although the house my daughter was in burned down last summer, so in a fire in California, so it can happen. But why? Because I know that there can be sudden jolts in the system, sudden surprises in the system. And so we always sold through the 1980s and 90s, we sold gold and silver as long-term insurance against unexpected and very ugly events that we saw that could come.
Now, the run-of-the-mill stockbroker would still consider that a fringe idea, because if you buy stocks in the long run, you'd be taken care of. And so in your mind, it's an issue of prudence and historical importance, because if you look at the record, things go off the rails with some regularity. You mentioned the man from Hungary, essentially our first client, going through the worst hyperinflation of the 20th century. And here he is, you know, a business executive in Colorado, but the past is very much present for him, and he has an interest in owning the physical metal. I wouldn't describe him as fringe. I would describe him as someone who's clued into the historical record and the perennial political tendency towards mismanagement of fiscal and monetary matters.
I think if, David, the underlying philosophy of our company, the newsletter that I've been writing for 43 years now, is trying to help people understand the times. The times and what people think they understand about the world, which they're told by the mainline media, the government, Wall Street, and so forth, is not, in my view, what is really happening in the world. So our effort is to help people understand the times and understand that, yeah, you can have periods of good time, but there's going to be some periods of real, real hard, painful times, and to help people prepare for those. So preparing for the difficult times has been kind of our company philosophy. And I think if you could go back and talk to our many clients, some of whom have passed on now, they would tell you that we have helped them tremendously over the last 30 or 40 years to protect assets and grow their net worth.
Now, you were involved with just a handful of other characters when you're getting gold ownership legalized here in the U.S. This is, I think, an important story and one of the things that kind of sets us apart as a business and as a family business. Share the story with us. Gold being legalized, you had a direct role in it.
Well, we certainly knew some of the players in Washington, Senator Helms, others in Washington who were in, and Jesse Helms and his team basically wrote the legislation to get it legalized in 1975. He wrote it in late 1974. So, yeah, we were in contact with them on that and other things, foreign affairs things in South Africa, which is also where the gold was, a lot of the gold was coming from.
What was the gentleman's name, Sagemark?
Howard Sagemark was the legislative aide, kind of director for Jesse Helms, a great guy. And between he and Jesse Helms, they wrote the legislation, which basically set us free. Now, I must tell you that what happened thereafter, you say, oh, that was really good news. Now, the day after it became legal in January 1 of 1975, the government came in and said, we are demonetizing gold for once and for all. We're getting rid of all of our gold, and the IMF is going to dump its gold. And they started, it was a massive manipulation. Gold had gone from $35 an ounce to $197.50. And they just began to, the manipulation in the media and from Wall Street and from the government was incredible. So they knocked it down in half. Over the next year and a half, they knocked gold. So the gold has just been legalized, and they have just now smashed it in the head with a hammer. And they knocked it down by 50% from $197.50 to $102. That was in late August, around August 27, 28, 29 of 1976. And I'll tell you a story, and this may be irrelevant, but I got so discouraged. I had had people tell me, McIlvaine, you're the last bull. When you throw in the towel, when you give up, when you say there's no more, it's over, I'm getting out, I can't stand it. I'm like the rat trapped in the trap. Just forget the cheese, I want out. When you get to that point, we're going to know we hit the bottom. So I can remember in August of 76, gold was 102, and they were predicting, Wall Street was predicting it was headed for back to $35 an ounce. I went up on a mountaintop in Aspen, Colorado, and I've joked, I've contemplated my navel. I don't know what I was contemplating, but I was so discouraged. I said, I'm getting out. This is it. It's over. So I was halfway down the mountain. It hit me. This epiphany hit me. Oh, my gosh. They've broken me. They've broken me. They said they would. I ran down. I called John Van Eck on the phone and said, John, this is the bottom. This is the bottom. It bottomed one day later. And from that point on, for the next 3.5 years, it moved up from 102 to 875 intraday high in early January of 1980. So anyway, but so much of what happened was manipulation. Now, it's important to understand, they manipulated it off and on throughout the 1980s and 90s, and they're manipulating gold today. And you'll come in, when somebody comes into the paper gold market and dumps billions of dollars of gold in a matter of less than 1 minute, that's not how you make money as a trader. And they can knock it down $20, $30 an ounce. So they're still manipulating gold. But what I learned in the 70s was the free market forces, the world monetary free market forces, will eventually overcome that manipulation. They knocked it down in half from 197.50 to 102 in an 18-month period. And from that point forward, it rose 8.5 times. Free market forces took over. And that will happen again and again, including today.
Well, again, kind of retrospective and in current tense, Reagan was the man who broke the mold. He increased the national debt by over $1 trillion. I'm not saying that was his greatest contribution, but he basically, in the process, bankrupted the Soviet Union. So from a strategic perspective, did have a win in that. But previously, there was only $1 trillion in debt, and it had taken from George Washington to Jimmy Carter to accumulate that trillion. And then in his short first period of his administration, he doubles the national debt. Now, what's interesting is we add that amount, $1 trillion, we add that amount to the national debt every year. And, you know, so I think when we reflect on what has been and what may be, the Bretton Woods Agreement, 1944, broke apart in 1971. We've been in a post-Bretton Woods period. But do we still risk monetary system repudiation? Even though we don't have a formal agreement like Bretton Woods, we still exist on a dollar-based standard the world over. Don't we threaten that at some point, playing with these debt thresholds, whether it's interest rates being the key there or just the mass quantities of debt?
Yes, we have the world's reserve currency. That was the result of, you know, to the victor goes the spoils after World War II. Okay. And that's helped build America to the number one power, economic power position in the world today, which has been rivaled some by China and others. That is now breaking down as we see it right now. A lot of people are turning away from the dollar. A lot of the people realize that our monetary authorities and politicians have manipulated the world monetary system through the dollar. And I think that the dollar is probably not 3 to 5 years from now, maybe less, maybe a little more. I think the dollar will not be the world's reserve currency. Now, the world monetary system is destabilizing rapidly, as you know, David. They're running the printing presses faster and faster and faster. Everybody wants to lower their currencies for trade purposes, including the United States. So I think we're moving towards a world monetary crisis. And there's a lot of talk, and I think some of it is reasonable, about gold coming back in some way into the global monetary system. But in the meantime, what lies ahead? I can remember in one of the Rocky movies when Clubber Lane was asked what was going to be the result of this fight. And he looked at it, and through his teeth, he said, pain. And I believe, David, that's what's coming. Pain is coming in the world monetary system. People are scrambling, and that's why central banks and people around the world, not the average dumb as a rock American investor, but people around the world are buying more gold now than they have in the last 10 or 12 years. Because they see the pain that's coming.
Yeah, the trend changed in December 2015, and there's been not only a gradual accumulation, but also an improvement in price. We were at $1,050 in the gold price, above $1,500 now, better than a 50% move. And I would guess that very few Americans are cognizant of that, primarily because the Dow, the S&P, and NASDAQ have all done well. And with fixation on those indexes, in part with the cheerleading of the mainstream media, there really hasn't been a lot of bandwidth for anything else or another conversation about other asset classes or whatnot. And so the move this time around, this 50% move higher, has been pretty undercover almost. And so I wonder if you would, you know, there's very few who I know who could share a perspective on sort of 5 decades of a particular asset class. 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, maybe we can speculate on what's ahead. But go back to the 70s, just kind of in a nutshell. Again, we're just going to do this kind of rapid fire 70s. Legalization of the metal, Bretton Woods, Kissinger, what's going on then?
David, I think there's been a tremendous change in the thinking of people in that five-generation period. People in the 70s, 60s and 70s were more readers. They didn't have the internet and even so much television distraction. It was there and it was growing. But I think you had a different generation. I think you had a much higher percentage of Americans, and I'm going to guess probably 5 to 10%, never a majority, who were thinkers, who understood the times, who wanted to understand the times, who were mavericks. I think that that has gradually gone away over the last five decades. Oh, result of liberal educational system, liberal media, government, Wall Street, brainwashing, et cetera, et cetera. And my view is there's less deep thinkers who understand the times. It's always been a minority, for sure. But I believe there's a lot less deep thinkers now than there were five decades ago. So I think that's one of the real differences.
But I want to focus on these particular time frames. The 1970s, you know, we've been living off of the benefits given to us in, you might even say singularly, by Henry Kissinger. As he stabilizes the dollar in the mid to late 70s through creating oil trade in dollars. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are things that we take for granted, but actually the dollar was in free fall. The Bretton Woods system is falling apart. The world monetary system is in collapse as we know it, and we make an arrangement with the Saudis. Now, all of a sudden, fast forward to today, we are a larger oil producer than the Saudis. We're not importing what we once were, and there's a growing audience of people who aren't interested in denominating the flow of commodities in dollar terms. So we had it in the 70s. We have that erosion today. Isn't that fair?
Absolutely. People saw the petrodollar, the dollar reserve system post-war and so forth as building America up. And it did. There's no doubt about it. But people have begun to think, we don't think that's such a good system. We don't like to see America calling the shots, foreign policy-wise, war-wise. They want wars here and there to rearrange things and so forth. So the masses out there, meaning the other countries, are beginning to rebel against the post-war dollar reserve system. And I don't think that's going to go back. It's not a pendulum. I think it's a situation where over the next 5 years, maybe 10 years, but in the foreseeable future, we will no longer have the world's reserve currency. I don't know what will be the rules. Maybe it'll be a basket of currencies. I don't think it'll be the Chinese currency. But whatever it is, it won't be primarily the American currency. We are losing credibility all over the world. We have been a bully and been pushing economically, financially, politically, militarily. We've been pushing people around all over the world. And people all over the world are saying, we've had it. We're through with this American-dominated system.
All right, so we now look at the 80s. You've got the end of a bull market in gold, which for the average investor might be discouraging to you. It's certainly not, because you think that owning gold is for insurance purposes against political stupidity and a variety of kinds of volatility which can emerge and have emerged historically. So as a ballast asset within a portfolio, you think it stays anyways. But there you are, the end of a bull run in the 80s. We did see some interesting ratio trades and things through that decade because there was huge volatility between gold and silver. Do you want to comment on what's the most important takeaway from the 80s?
Well, I think for me, the most important takeaway is gold is an insurance policy against massive disaster. And we were not just in the gold business, we were in the insurance business. And so in a very real sense, we didn't really care if gold went up or down. We were selling people long-term insurance. Well, okay, let's say that gold is effectively is moving sideways, and it was moving sideways with a downward slant. But you could, because gold and silver would fluctuate in a ratio towards one another, there would be times when you could switch out of your gold into silver. Silver would be undervalued versus gold, and the ratio would, and it's adjusted different ways at different times. We saw people, and when we did ratio trading throughout the 80s and 90s, we saw people literally double their money over a period of 5-10 years
And the price
in a flat gold market.
Price of gold and silver was not helping them.
So we by doing the ratio trading, we helped people to continue to make money even in a flat market. So we were basically helping people make money on their insurance policy even before the disaster came.
Well, and maybe that bleeds over into the 90s in terms of there being opportunities even in the context of a bear market in metals, because it still was a bear market in metals.
Sure.
Was the greater pressure in the gold market as you got through the 90s, the central bank pressure, selling gold?
Yeah, I think you've had central banks and governments always manipulating gold and pushing it down. They thrive on paper. Paper is their modus operandi. And so, sure, you are going to continue, and you will continue even now to see them doing that. So central banks, of course, led by the U.S. Treasury, our Federal Reserve, the IMF, and so forth, they're always going to be biased against gold. That has never changed, was very acute during that time, but it's still acute. It's still there.
Richard Silla joined us on the commentary last week, mm-hmm. and he wrote The History of Interest Rates, 4,000 Years of History on Interest Rates. And one of the things that he has pointed out in the book is this shift in interest, governmental interest, towards bonds. And you can see this when you look at central banks. They shifted interest from gold into paper assets in a period of time where interest rates were contracting and the value of those financial assets was going up. So the allure of making money on the paper side was too great for them to just kind of sit there and watch what they would view as a debt asset, gold as a reserve, sit there and do nothing while financial assets were just going bonkers. So you've got Gordon Brown, who basically put in the low, dumping Bank of England gold as we head towards the turn of the millennium. And lo and behold, we enter
dumping,
into,
by the way, at the bottom.
That's right.
At the bottom of the market.
Yeah, we were at about 275, 300, and with his pressure, we get to about 252, 253 on the gold price. But then all of a sudden, the 2000s, we have a roaring bull market in gold for over a decade, and stocks do nothing. They do nothing. So the central bank timing in terms of dumping gold to get into financial assets may have been rewarding for like a 1998, 1999 period, but ended up being a disaster. Of course, they don't get marked or graded or fired on the basis of portfolio performance. But anything that you would say about sort of the year 2000s in the early stages of the most recent bull market?
I'm not sure what I would say about then, but let me ask you now another question. I answer that question with a question. What would you say about the central banks now piling into gold around the world today? Because today they're buying gold. They're buying gold very rapidly.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the one hand, I'm not sure if that's good news or bad news for us. there is the skeptic in me that says they're rarely doing the right thing at the right time. But I think one of the things that it does suggest is a disaffection with the U.S. dollar. And the move is perhaps for different reasons. An insulation against currency decline, a diversification away from dollars. There's a motivation, which is, I think, fundamentally different than what was in the late 90s, moving out of gold reserves into paper assets, which was almost like playing the markets with governmental balance sheets. But here we are, we spent the last decade, 9 years to 8 years, consolidating a 5x move in the price of gold, more than that, the price of silver from $450 to almost $50, a 10x move in silver. And it looks like we've begun the next leg higher in the gold price. After a 50% move higher over the last 3-4 years, it looks that way.
I would add to that. I think in the past, we know that central banks manipulate, suppress gold, et cetera, et cetera. Today, I believe they're buying gold because of fear. I believe that they see major looming problems in the world financial system, currency system, the trade war, potential for shooting wars, et cetera, et cetera. I think there is genuine fear on the part of the central banks, and I believe that's why they're buying as much gold as they're buying today.
So we look at the next decade, that last decade in question, the 2020s, and kind of speculate, where do we go from here? Why? How do we get there? What are the dysfunctional factors that are motivating investors, whether it's in the United States or abroad?
Fear is a big factor in people buying gold. When they see instability around them or right on the horizon, they look at gold as a safe haven. I live in Asia now, and I see it from a very different perspective. but people have concerns about China, who is massing troops by the Hong Kong border now, a conflict in the South China Sea. That's geopolitical conflict.
Let me interrupt you there because, you know, today you live pretty close to that area. You live in the Philippines. You're, you know, a couple hundred miles if you're looking at the Spratly Islands and the conflict that is potential, like geographic, just sort of regional geographic conflict the Chinese have staked a claim. Paracel Islands, Spratly Islands, this is off of the coast of the Philippines, and you're kind of, you know, in a short summary, why are you there, and I think you're going to stay, aren't you?
We're planning to stay. I hope it's not like the Japanese invasion back in 1941. We're planning to stay. We work with orphans out there, and we feel like we had a new calling in our life to, oh, not exactly give up gold coins, but move from an emphasis on gold coins to an emphasis on orphans. So my wife and I are involved in 8 orphanages with 500 kids scattered all over Asia. And so that's kind of where we are. But we get a good perspective on the monetary, economic, and geopolitical differences of opinion, differences of what people see and so forth. And I think people in that part of the world see the world destabilizing very rapidly. And we see it destabilizing very rapidly. And
have you seen the Chinese get more aggressive in recent years? And does that show up in kind of the dialogue between Xi Jinping and a Duterte? What does that look like?
They are getting much more aggressive. They are pushing forward in many areas, not just in the South China Sea, but they're making rumbles against Taiwan and so forth. And this is a source of major concern to the nations, all the nations out there, and of course to us as well. So geopolitically, things are destabilizing. Is it looking exactly like it did when Japan moved out across Southeast Asia? No, I wouldn't say that. And there is pressures, our pressures against the Chinese government from the American government with the trade war and so forth. And so things are destabilizing, and I think over the next 5 or 10 years, things could get quite unstable geopolitically in that part of the world. And does that cause us loss of sleep? No, but we keep our eye on it very, very closely.
We get together periodically and discuss business-related things. You're still involved, not necessarily the day-to-day operations of the precious metals brokerage business or the wealth management business, but still from a strategic perspective. We chat, and the launch of our business, the wealth management business in 2008, came from a conversation that you and I had had in 2005 about what we would do at the end of a bull market in metals, what kind of a message would we carry to our clients, what advice would we give them in light of what we ourselves were doing. And the two words which were on the tip of our tongue in the front of our minds then as now were income and diversification. You still, from our conversation today, sound like you're an enthusiastic owner and purchaser of precious metals, but why would you consider something other than gold?
Well, it's not wise to put all your eggs in one basket. I think we all know that. And there will be times when gold is moving forward like we see today, and then there will be times when it's very, very quiet and other things are moving ahead. As we all know, we can agree gold does not produce income. So I think a balance. Now, the question is, how much gold do you have? And then how much do you have in other assets? I would say for most people, it would be wise to have at least 25% of one's net worth in gold. And I personally believe at least a quarter of that should be stored abroad just in case our government would ever become more obnoxious or whatever. With that said, what do you do with the other 75%, if 25% makes sense? I think income producing real estate in the right place, and we've actually looked at a little of that. I'm very cautious about the world's stock markets. The bond markets look like a disaster waiting to happen. The negative interest rates are messing things up dramatically. I see a time when we may look back on this time right now and say, oh my gosh, I wish we'd have had 110% of our assets in gold. But I think prudence says that we diversify. Yes, some stocks, right positions, maybe a short fund, maybe gold stocks at the right time and so forth. I think income producing real estate, I think diversification does make sense. But I think that if you don't have as the basic foundation of your strategy gold, and I mean physical gold, in your possession or stored somewhere where it's very safe, I think that you would be in error.
Well, one of the things that we've tried to anticipate is not only
your needs, our investor base needs in terms of income, but also just a reflection on where we feel most comfortable, which is with real things. After 50 years of dealing with hard assets and real assets are something that are almost second nature to us. So you mentioned real estate. It's a real thing. It's a hard asset. But owning things like pipelines and cell towers and waterworks and real things with cash flow, you can have the best of both worlds. It's not exclusively gold, but you can own real things with cash flow. And that's been our emphasis and greatest interest today with our wealth management group. And I think we'll continue to be a major theme in the years ahead, because real things, regardless of the monetary policy experiments which are going on, regardless of the fiscal profligacy which is repeated over and over again, whether it's in the U.S. or anywhere else, real things give you an insulation to a degree. And income, certainly, in terms of the total return picture, gives you some insulation to a degree.
Well, David, the Wall Street, the government, the financial establishment is both our friend and our enemy, and I put the emphasis probably on the latter. Among other things, they've created a situation where you almost cannot go normally in the normal way and make income. What are retirees to do when interest rates are moving towards zero, when bond rates are very, very low, et cetera, et cetera? Therefore, the need for a wealth management where people who understand the times and understand where you should be in the markets and how to diversify in those kinds of times, the need for your kind of wealth management is greater than ever. So the government is creating, government of Wall Street are creating with their low interest rates, a new set of needs. And we need people who are smart and intelligent and understand these things, can help guide things through a very complicated situation.
Getting the right team together is a challenge. Finding good people in terms of integrity, character, along with the right skill set and expertise in a particular area. Putting all that together in a package, I'm glad we started in 2008, because it's taken over a decade to get that team together. But I'm pretty excited about who's on that team today and where we're going as an organization.
I think your team is skilled. That is great. But I think that one of the greatest assets is we need people who are leading us, guiding us, who understand the times, who understand not just what we see on the surface, but understand the times well enough to see what is coming. Well, that is one of the things I've tried to do with my newsletter. My McIlvaine Intelligence Advisor, I've written for 43 years. We try to help people understand the times, and your people are people who understand the times. So, yes, they know how to maneuver in difficult markets. That's very, very important. But understanding the times and what's coming maybe is even more important.
Well, I want to end where we began, which was, the why. We're interested in things as they evolve. I think in terms of my heartbeat, it's very similar to yours. We're interested in understanding the truth of matters, not as we want them to be to us, but as they actually are. And there is something of a pressing in to a different reality in that sense. And so why we do what we do is perhaps different than other Wall Street companies or money management groups or even gold companies. But I just want to say I appreciate the influence that you've had on our community, that is the companies that we manage today, having a deeper purpose, being on a rescue mission, being involved in a cause. Obviously, that's on evidence even today, although the management of the businesses is less of interest to you, and the involvement in saving individual kids, getting them through college, giving them a different leg up in life that they wouldn't have otherwise throughout Asia. It's still who you've always been. And I think I would encourage all of our listeners to look at their lives in some respects the way you have. Look at your gifts, look at your talents, look at your passions, and recognize that in different chapters they may have different expressions. But who you are was by design. And who you can be, the impact that you can have, it's important to take account of how you can impact other people's lives. Yep, today, for me, it is the businesses and managing the businesses, and that helps you and Mom be out there and do what you're doing. But what you're doing is no different than what you've always done. you're on a rescue mission. You have a deeper purpose. You have a cause. And working with those kids is great. If anybody's interested, the Asian Pacific Children's Fund is the group that you put together nearly 20 years ago and is involved with the homes that you mentioned, 8 different homes throughout Asia. And you'd love to work with more. You'd love to work with 80 if you could. If you could find the right ones to partner with and had the resources, resource limitation is always a part of an expansion issue. But for those who are unfamiliar with Don's work, Asian Pacific Children's Fund, what is the website?
Lowercase apcfund.com, as in Asian Pacific Children's Fund.
Life is short. We're reminded of that in many ways, and making sure that your life is of meaning and significance as it reaches into others is important. I wanted our listeners and our clients to be reminded of the role that you played in the legalization of gold, because something that we take for granted is actually part of our company history and a part of your contribution to the financial landscape. But your contribution is not limited to that.
David, in a coin business, we've been in business for 47 years. With the newsletter, we've been in business for 43 years. And that's actually been in a time when many, many of our suppliers, our competitors have gone out of business and so forth. And I think what has been the underlying dynamic behind what I've done, you've done, we've all done together, is we want to help people understand the times. And second, we want to help people prepare for difficult times. Our goal is to help people. I believe, and I think we all believe, that there could be some difficult times out there on the horizon. And if we can help people navigate through those difficult times and come out well on the other side, that has been our almost a half a century goal. And that will continue to be our goal for the next half a century.
You know, I have to say there is certainly a personality difference between the two of us. There's a looming danger always in your mind, and that's part of who you are. And in the language of options trading, in our family, you've always been the put, and I've always been the call. I'm the growth and the positive thinker, and you are the head for the hills, keep your bags packed, keep your options open. It may go wrong, and that may be the best case scenario.
I have to. One of my most unfavorite people, I have a favorite quote from Lenin. I think we all know him. He was the father of communism, and he said, "Worse is better." Worse is better. And I've always liked that statement, because out of hard times, out of difficult times, come great opportunity. Sometimes in normal, healthy times, and everybody's comfortable, you know, nothing really changes. But out of difficult times, when things get worse, you can have breakthroughs and you can make a difference. This is the way Patton thought in between World War I and World War II. Worse is better. He savored the opportunity. When the crisis came, there were going to be breakthroughs and he could move forward. And that's my philosophy. Worse can be better.
Well, and this is probably where we do meet in the middle, because whether it's volatility in the markets or hardship that people experience, there are moments to grow and opportunities that only open in those moments. So, yeah, on kind of a positive note, we can wrap it there. We look forward to the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades. Appreciate your persistence and your perseverance through the last 47. And as a second generation family business, hopefully heading to a third and fourth, anticipate the next 47 years with great enthusiasm. Thanks for your contribution.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and his father, Don McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.